Isaiah chapter 2 begins in a way that will help you see, at least in principle, what's happening. It begins, "The word Isaiah son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem." It sounds a bit like an introduction, doesn't it? So it's likely that this is where the Isaiah scroll started at one stage. And then in a later thing, they've brought in chapter 1 as an overview of the whole, because justice is his big issue, and put there, and so that, but they've kept the old one there. So it's an odd kind of thing to put at chapter 2, verse 1, if you've got chapter 1 already going and have it already introduced. So I'm suggesting to you that chapter 2 and the rest of them here are chapter 2 through to 5, we're only going to do 2 to 4 today, was Isaiah's earliest preaching. Now, I can't prove that, but that's what I think it is. Because chapter 6, as you'll see when we prepare for next week, is on the talks about when King Uzziah died. And Isaiah has this vision in the temple, fantastic vision in the temple. That's in chapter 6. So that's the beginning of a mission that he was called on, but not the beginning of his prophetic career. So I think what we're dealing with here, to go back to last week, in chapter 2 through 5, is what Isaiah was saying in those early years of his ministry while Uzziah, the king, was still alive, but no longer exercising his kingship. His son was the regent. And that was all explained last week. I won't say any more about it. Here we've got wonderful chapter, wonderfully organized chapter 2. We're beginning here in chapter 2, verses 2 to 4, with what I suggest is eschatological. Now, what does that mean? It's one of those words you don't pass exams unless you know. Eschatological. The prophets were concerned with here and now, and their words were addressed to the people who could do something about here and now, basically the king and the other leaders, who were Jews. Do you get it? So they're within their own world, and they're saying, do something about this. Get the administration more fair. Don't join this group. Stop these alliances and bringing foreign gods into the temple. Get real and live the way we're supposed to live. That's the prophetic movement. The kings stopped with the exile. So after the exile, prophecy stops, basically. Because the prophetic movement, who are they going to talk to now? They're going to talk to the king of Persia and tell him, look, you should be living according to Yahweh. He'd say, well, really, it's Yahweh. You know what I mean? It won't work anymore. So the eschatology means there's a kind of hope. They're not in their own country. It's owned by someone else. They're there on loan, as it were. They've lost everything. They've got some things they're working on. Eschatology means looking for God to intervene to set things right again. The ultimate intervention of God. So it's looking to the future. The idea of a Messiah begins. One day we will have our own king. Do you get it? We haven't got one now. We've got a governor. We haven't got a king. One day we'll get our own. God will do this. God. So it's looking outside history, because history's in a mess. We're not able to do anything. We're too small. There's too few of us. We've got no power. And we had no power under Persia. We had no power under Greece. We've got no power under Rome. And then after 70, what the heck have we got? We're nowhere. Did you get it? So it's a looking out, dangerous, by the way, stuff to be doing, looking outside history and people to a God who'll come and do something. That's basically eschatology. Well, this is an eschatological introduction. The post-exilic editors introduce Yahweh's words in such a way as to challenge their contemporaries to learn from the mistakes of the past and to take up the mission to the world, because the Isaiah group were very strong on mission, that Yahweh had given them by bringing them back to Judah and rebuilding the temple. So that's what they're doing, but they're doing it within an environment of longing for God to intervene and make this somehow possible. So let's read the text and see if that what I've just said makes sense to you. In the days to come, can you see it? There's the eschatology. In the days to come, the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains. If you've ever been to Jerusalem, it's not the highest of the mountains. Jerusalem is there, and over there is in Jordan, across the Jordan River, is a 3,000-foot thing. I don't know how high Jerusalem is, I can't remember for the moment. But they're looking up. Jerusalem is surrounded by the higher mountains. But Jerusalem is going to be the highest of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills. All nations shall stream to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob. They're not doing it now. The fog is a bit interested in it, and it's a bit of a ramshackle temple anyhow we've got. But the day will come when the whole world... And can you see... Keep reading between the lines to get the... Can you see the Christian vision picking this up? And can you see Jesus taking Judaism to the world? And can you see the whole point of Catholic? They were called Catholic in the end of the first century, this group of Christians, because it's universal. It's all embracing. It's not a group anymore. It's to do with go and baptize all nations. All nations, you see? So it's the Christians were inspired by this, and of course by this, as lived by Jesus, to say the dream will come true, but, please don't miss it, do you remember Luke's gospel at the Ascension? They're looking, as the story, it's a story, looking up, and the angel comes, angel, inspiration, and says, stop looking up to heaven, for God's sake. Go back to Jerusalem, wait for the Spirit, and then get on with your mission. Do you get it? It's not eschatological. It's real mission now. Do it. You've got the Spirit. You do it, and stop saying to God, why don't you do it? God says to you, why don't you do it? So it's something, it's eschatological in that sense, but it's about the future being now. It's all happening in these last days. Latter-day saints, that's where they got the word from. So, come, they'll say, let us go to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the Torah. Do you remember Luke's gospel, the way it's constructed, the Acts of the Apostles? Begins in Jerusalem, goes into Judah, goes into Samaria, and to the ends of the world, and ends at the Acts of the Apostles in Rome, the very centre of the empire. So it's the same idea. It'll go forth out of Jerusalem, out of the Torah, and the word of Yahweh will go from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. Has that happened yet? It won't happen till we do it. And their spears into pruning hooks. So there are still people who believe that you'll destroy Hamas by destroying all these people. I cannot believe they're that stupid, but anyhow, that's what they think they'll do. We'll destroy Hamas. And if I was a little Gaza boy and saw my elder sister bloody butchered and my parents thing and my home destroyed, who would I join? I'd join Hamas. And I'd got nothing to lose. Of course I would. So would you. We all would. And they do. Anyhow, I'm not here to talk about it. I just can't. Because they haven't got the idea yet. And then, have we got the idea? Has anyone got the idea? Or are we still caught up in this violence will bring peace? You'd think after last century, and what my family had people, your family, you'd think we'd have decided there's got to be a better way. And it's complicated, and I'm sorry I've said anything about it in a way, but here it is. They'll beat their swords into plowshares. That's the dream, that's the hope, but God isn't going to do it. Their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. What a dream, what a hope. And keep the dream alive. But don't look up to heaven waiting for it. So now that's the introduction, and now from his early ministry we have these texts. The contrast between 2:2-4, which we've just read, and the rest of chapter 2 could not be more striking. We've heard that the mountain of Yahweh's house will be exalted. We're going to hear that the mountains of human arrogance are going to be brought down. It's poetry. It's powerful stuff. We've heard that the nations will flow to Yahweh's mountain to learn of God and to walk in God's ways in those few verses. But in the rest of the chapter, we're about to hear that Jerusalem is full of foreigners, soothsayers, who worship their own inventions. We've heard in that introductory dream, hope, eschatological statement, we've heard that the nations will reject weapons of violence, but we're going to hear in the rest of this chapter that the rulers of Jerusalem are pursuing trade in horses and chariots. And horses weren't to take to Randwick Racecourse to bet on. Horses in the whole Bible, that is the tank. That's the ammunition. That's the way to win a war is with horses. We've heard that peace and harmony will be the result of Yahweh's reign. And we're just about to hear of the terror, fear, and humiliation that is rife in Judah. So the people who edited the text and put it together had to put something in first, or no one would have read beyond chapter 2. It was just too dire, too hard. So they're trying to keep the dream alive while they're critiquing the behaviour of their people. And here, set out as best I can for you, is the text. House of Jacob. And the scholars suggest he's talking to the royal house of Judah. Come, walk into Yahweh's light. If you looked up your New Revised Standard Version, or what have you got version there? No. Oh, could you just read it out? What does it say for that verse 5? Let us walk in the light which the Lord gives us. I suggest to you the Hebrew is saying walk into it, because they're not in it. Do you get it? It's translations. They're always a bit. You have rejected your people, house of Jacob. What does it say there? O God, you have forsaken your people, the descendants of Jacob. I've translated it. You have rejected your people, house of Jacob. Yes. They both can't be right. So you've got to go back to the Hebrew. You've got to know the Hebrew. You've got to argue about it. And the people who wrote that knew the Hebrew. So I'm just letting you know that translation is a tricky business, because it's going to depend on the insight that strikes you and the way through it. And what I'm offering you here is the translation offered me in Italian 20-something years ago by the professor who taught this text to me, and he was very convincing, that's all I can say. So it's not just my thoughts, but yeah, if you're going to... Yeah, don't argue from the Bible unless you know Hebrew. And if you do, you still might have to be very... Like in everything, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. So, but I'm doing my best to give you the feel of the text as I've understood it from then and further study. And he's telling the, I believe, not believe, I think I know, that he's actually critiquing the leaders of Jerusalem because they have rejected their own people. Indeed, they are full of diviners from the east and soothsayers from Philistines. They clasp hands with foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there's no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there's no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands. Bow down to the work of their hands. Stand up, anyone who's innocent and has never done that. Like, I'm standing, that's an accident. The collapse that's happened in the economic system, could that be the result of idolatry of the market? And so people are humbled and everyone is brought low. He's describing the situation at the death of Uzziah, the political collapse, which I talked about last week. The Assyrians are coming in and the place is falling apart, and he's naming from God as he sees it why it's happening. Is he totally right? No. but he's got a point of view that's worth listening to. So with that description of the situation, this is his second exhortation now. Don't raise your eyes to them, to the idols. Go to the rock. Go to the rock. Stay hidden in the dust in terror of Yahweh and the glory of his majesty. Go to the rock. The rock is Yahweh. Do you mind reading out your text again? Just go to the rock. Verse 9.
Yes. Everyone will be humiliated and disgraced. Do not forget them, Lord.
Isn't that dreadful? Yeah, there we are. So you just got to watch it.
Yeah.
So don't trust me any more than you trust that. But this is how do you translate? How do you know? So the haughtiness of people, this is a theme, this will come a refrain. The haughtiness of people shall be brought low. The pride of everyone shall be humbled. And Yahweh alone will be exalted in that day. That day when justice prevails, when we do our mission, when we go to the rock. For Yahweh of hosts has a day against all the proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up and high. Against all the cedars of Lebanon, the mightiest trees in the locality, lofty and lifted up. Against all the oaks of Bashan. Bashan's up on the Golan Heights, and they were famous for its cattle and also its trees and forests. Against the high mountains, against all the lofty hills, against every high tower and against every fortified world. Against all the ships of Tarshish. We're not sure where Tarshish was. It's got a few opinions on that. But it meant the ships that could go right out into the middle of the Mediterranean didn't just hug the shores. They were able to cope with the storms and they were the biggest trading ships of the day. Well, they are all the mighty things that everyone thinks mighty and all their beautiful craft are nothing compared to God, to Yahweh. The haughtiness of people shall be humbled. The pride shall be brought low. Yahweh alone will be exalted on that day. The idols shall utterly pass away. So, enter the caves of rocks and the holes of the ground in terror of Yahweh and the glory of his majesty when he rises to cause the earth to quake. On that day, people will throw away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they've made for themselves to worship, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts in the crags. So if you don't go to the rock, you're going to end up going to the rocks, is the point he's making. So get your priorities straight. Get your focus right. Live according to the... Yahweh is your God, the unnamed one, the one that you can't control or pin down or the mystery one. But it's about justice, it's about freedom, it's about love, it's all, you know that. In again the refrain, in terror of Yahweh and the glory of his majesty when he rises to cause the earth to quake. A text, the day of the Lord is a scriptural theme which I guess I've done on other occasions with you, and that's what we're talking about here. Either they go to the rock or they'll find themselves fleeing to the rocks in a vain attempt to avoid judgment. Let's jump to Paul, whose language is biblical. He's trained in it. But there's going to be a shift in his understanding, of course, thanks to Jesus. Such a big shift that he became a Christian. He shifted dramatically because of a new understanding of all of this that he got. Well, here's Paul. In the second letter to the Thessalonians, the Lord Jesus will be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, inflicting vengeance on those who do not know God and on those who do not obey the gospel of the Lord Jesus. These will suffer the punishment of eternal destruction, separated from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his might. That's Jesus. The gentle Jesus, the loving Jesus. So what's he talking about in that text? He's not going to say suddenly Jesus is going to turn vicious. And he's not going to say Jesus will get you back in the long run. You know, you're going to cop it sweet. Surely, he's saying in the whole of his, is what I do with my life matters. It matters. And it has effects. You can't dream them away. And God doesn't dream them away. And Jesus can't dream them away. He weeps over the city. He doesn't say, oh, good on you, city, go for it. Jerusalem, that's great. Doesn't matter this or that. We're all going the same way. You choose your way of life, unjust, and I'll do my thing, and we're all in this together, and great, go for it. He doesn't say that. He weeps over the city and says, why don't you understand what you're doing? And so it goes on. And when he clasps hold of Judas in the garden, he doesn't say, thanks, Judas, this is marvellous. The whole system's working. He says, why are you doing this? Why do you betray me with a kiss? And so on, you know. So he's, in other words, Jesus alerts me and you to the fact that what we do matters. It matters that we make decisions. It matters that we change. And it matters eternally. It's not as if we, and people say there couldn't be a hell because God couldn't be that. God is loving. All right. I couldn't be in prison for drug addiction because my mother was such a loving mother. Does it work like that? Love is love, it's not control, and you can have the best parents in the world and turn out pretty bad by your own decisions and my own decisions. And they matter. And they and when we die, there's suddenly not a waving wand, so the church talks about hell. Jesus talked about hell, however we imagine it. But the centre of hell is being separated. That's what hell is, that's all it is. But that's big. Separated from the presence of the Lord and the glory of his power, might. So Christianity hasn't softened any of this. Back to Isaiah. It's nicely balanced. Another exhortation. Turn away from mortal human beings in whose nostrils is breath. What account are they? So what on earth are you doing siding with Prince Whoop Whoop of wherever it is, Babylon or in fact it's Assyria. What are you doing about all this? They're only breath. It's only baloney. Get real. Get with what matters. Another description. For now the sovereign Adonai, Yahweh of hosts, is taking away from Jerusalem and Judah the support and staff, all support of bread, all support of water. Warrior and soldier, judge and prophet, diviner and elder, captain of 50 and dignitary, counselor and skillful magician and expert enchanter. What's he talking about? The deportation from Judah and possibly going to be from Jerusalem, though that didn't work out, they were saved. Is he talking about the anarchy at the time? I think so. Here's another. The description continues. I will make boys their princes, and babes shall rule over them. People will be oppressed one by another, and everyone by his neighbour. Youth will be insolent to the elder, and the base to the honourable. Someone will even seize a relative, a member of his clan, saying, you've got a cloak, you be our leader. This heap of ruins will be under your rule. Anarchy, see? Why don't you do it? Oh, yeah, you be king. But the other will cry out on the day saying, I won't be a healer. In my house there's neither bread nor cloak. You shall not make me leader of my people. And if you hear it in Hebrew and it's acted out, you'd probably be laughing and crying and doing all the rest of it. For Jerusalem has stumbled. Judah has fallen. Because their speech and their deeds are against Yahweh, defying his glorious presence. The look on their faces bears witness against them. They proclaim their sin like Sodom. They don't hide it. Woe to them. Here it is. They have brought evil on themselves. So the Bible works at two levels. We do it ourselves, but somehow in the whole providence of God, God is seen as doing the punishing. And that's tricky, and we've got to shift a little bit in the light of Jesus, I think, on that. We bring it on ourselves as they realize. He exhorts them, say this, how good things are for the just. He will feed on the fruits of his deeds. Woe to the unjust, it will go ill with him, for he will be treated as his actions deserve. And then comes another description of what's going on at the time. My people, children are their oppressors, women rule over them. Oh, my people, your leaders mislead you. They confuse the course of your paths. Yahweh rises to argue his case, says Isaiah. He stands to judge the peoples. Yahweh enters into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people, by grinding the face of the poor, says the Lord of hosts? And I've got references in the book commentary and here to Amos and Micah. There's a massive amount of this in the prophets about justice. It has to be their key issue, really. Chapter 3, continuing this, it's one kind of movement of poetry. And I think this is how you're to read it. The rebellious towns of Judah are behaving like spoiled daughters, flaunting their ill-gotten wealth. They'll be brought so low that they'll be desperately looking for security from anyone who'll support them, and to no avail. See, it's a poem, so you've got to, there's metaphor going on. Yahweh said, because the daughters of Jerusalem are haughty and walked with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, mincing along as they go, tinkling with their feet. Well, you could think he's having a go at the girls. And not that women would ever behave like that, but that's the image he's using. But you see, I think what he's doing is he's talking about the daughter cities of Jerusalem. So they're not girls, they're men and boys and women, and it's the whole. So watch the metaphors. Be careful about taking poetry literally, of course. But the image is clever, and I don't think the leaders of the cities that would fancy themselves being likened to this any more than I would fancy just because I wear an Albert mass. You looking at me as though I was prancing around in like a transvestite. I wouldn't take to that too well. The Lord will afflict with scabs the heads of the daughters of Zion, and Yahweh will lay bare their... You have to work the rest out for yourself. So they're going to be a little bit embarrassed, this lot. In that day the Lord will take away the finery of the anklets, the headbands, the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets, the scarfs, the headdresses, the armlets, the sashes, the perfume boxes and the amulets. How are you going, girls? The signet rings and the nose rings, the festal robes, the mantles, the cloaks, the handbags, the garments of gauze, the linen garments, the turbans and the veils. Holy smoke! You thought you were good buyers when you go to... But you don't have half these things. Instead of perfume, there'll be a stench. Instead of a sash, there'll be a rope. Instead of well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a binding of sackcloth. Instead of beauty, there'll be shame. He's not attacking the women. You see what's happening? He's using that image to look at the whole society and the stupidity of its frivolous behaviour. And the judgment, your men will fall by the sword, your warriors in battle. Her gates shall lament and mourn, ravaged she shall sit upon the ground. Seven women will take hold of one man in that day, saying, we'll eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Just let us be called by your name. Take away our disgrace. There's so few men because they've been killed in battle that there'll be seven women trying to grab every man they can just so they can be married and have kids and haven't wasted their life as virgins, which is a negative term in the Hebrew world because you haven't had children. So you got the message? So now we come to a gentle end. Oh, gentle. That's the judgment. That's Isaiah as a young man, I think, giving it full works. Some are listening and some aren't. And it ends just as it began, chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. The whole thing ends with chapter 4, verse 2 to 6, which is all the verses in chapter 4, and concludes our day with this oracle, this dream that it'll all be good, all will be well. Like chapter 2, verse 1 to 4, this verses 2 to 6 in chapter 4 is written from a post-exilic perspective. Isaiah's dire warnings, in fact, went unheeded in general. Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 BC. Its leading citizens were deported to Babylon. You could say, as Isaiah foresaw, but it's not a very good term. Isaiah doesn't foresee the destruction of Jerusalem. Isaiah is looking at people, and the prophets are all like this, looking at what people are now doing and saying, if you continue doing this, this is what's going to happen. But it's always an if. If you don't, it won't. And so it's not looking in a crystal ball and seeing what's going to happen in 150 years' time. It's saying, as we all can see, these are the consequences if you keep going the way you're going. This is going to happen. Now, in fact, something similar did happen because people didn't listen. But that wasn't because the prophet foresaw it. It's because he saw what would happen if people didn't listen. With Babylon's capitulation to Cyrus of Persia, a remnant returned to Judah to rebuild the city and the temple. We looked at this last week. The worst is over, as the people write the Isaiah scroll. The shadow of the past hangs over them. Its lessons mustn't be forgotten. But Yahweh's fidelity to his people has opened up for them a new future. An undreamed of future. They're back home. They do have a temple. The priesthood, the sacrifices are in place. They've got at least something going. And that's a miracle. They saw it as stunningly marvellous. But they want the people to learn the lessons of the past and don't just go downhill again. Because of the obvious political weakness of Judah, now part of the western province of the vast Persian Empire at the time of writing of this bit, those who wanted to inspire hope for a glorious future looked towards Yahweh's intervention. I talked about that with you earlier, the eschatological view. God would have to do something. Come down, do something for us. And can't you see how Christians saw God's answer to that prayer in Jesus as God's answer? But now it depends on us picking it up and doing it. The way they understood him to have intervened miraculously to restore them to Judah against all the odds. So the text reads, on that day, the shoot that Yahweh has planted, and I've just got a little note for you, in the Aramaic, they call it a targum. Targum just means in Aramaic translation. So the Aramaic, because the people, Hebrew was the language of the Bible, but when they went into exile, they learnt another language, Aramaic, which is related. They picked up the alphabet, because when you read a Hebrew Bible now, the alphabet, the letters are Aramaic, because they had their own Hebrew ones, which were much more primitive, really. So they picked it, but they didn't only pick that up, they picked up the language too, which was related, but bigger and vaster, and now they're part of the empire. So people, their kids were learning Aramaic and didn't, just like in Europe at one stage, you know, Latin, everyone spoke kind of Latin, but then gradually Portuguese and Spanish and Italian and the Romance languages emerge, and then you find when Latin is read, you can get a bit of a way. If you're an Italian, you hear Latin, you'll guess your way through it, but you won't quite get it. Get it? So it was similar here. And when they translated, if that's the right word, when they put into Aramaic the text so that it could be heard by the people, the word they used there was Mashiach, Messiah. This is the word Messiah, which becomes post-exilic, of course, and becomes important to us. On that day, the Messiah, let's use that word, the shoot, though, is in the Hebrew, it's coming out of the that Yahweh has planted shall be beautiful. It shall be glorious. And the fruit of the land shall be the pride and glory of the survivors of Israel. Whoever is left in Zion, say the people putting the text together in the post-exilic world, and remain, whoever remains in Jerusalem, will be called holy. Everyone who's been recorded for life in Jerusalem. And I've highlighted that because that in Matthew's texts, in chapter whatever it is it one or two, it says that in Jesus is fulfilled the prophet's words, he will be called holy. Do you vaguely? Well, that's the text. Now, it's not a strict quote. They often aren't strict quotes. But it's linking, when Matthew is writing, he's not telling us that Isaiah or anybody else, whoever Isaiah is here, you know, the whole community, he's not saying they foresaw Jesus. He's saying if you look at Jesus, you will see that he fulfills, brings to flowering the spirituality, the dreams, the hopes of the ancient prophets. He's the one. Look at it, because most of the Jews were saying Jesus was a maverick. He was a, you know, Galilean heretic. He was, you know, they dismissed him. And the Christian Jews are saying to their brothers and sisters and aunties and uncles, you got it wrong. Go back and read your text again properly, and you'll see that what the prophets were dreaming about, hoping for, seeing in prayer, Jesus actually fulfills it. Look at him. Get it? He's the fulfillment of it. Not meaning they foresaw it, but that he is really the flowering of all this. So he will be called holy. He's the Messiah. Once the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, cities, the subject, or whatever the word is, cities, cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of burning, a fire that will burn away the dross, then Yahweh will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over its places of assembly. And this is quite beautiful. Going right back to the ancient imagery, what will he create? A cloud by day and smoke and the shining of a flaming fire by night. What are you thinking of? Moses, the Exodus. Imagery here, of course. So it's going to be we're going to go back to our original dreams and hopes and purity and so on. Indeed, over all the glory, there will be a canopy. It will serve as a pavilion, a shade by day from the heat, and a refuge and a shelter from the storm and the rain. So what have we done today? We've looked at chapter 2 to 4, or 1 to 4, sorry, and we've seen chapter 1, which looks over the whole of the Isaiah scroll, and we'll keep coming. Justice is the key issue there, surely. And then we've got a selection of what I suggest to you is Isaiah's early preaching, which was pretty powerful and pretty, you know, we wouldn't have been liked for it. And it's surrounded, beginning and end, later, by a kind of a hopeful dream based not on what people are actually doing, but on the fact that whatever we do, God will be faithful. So there will be a new heaven and a new earth. That's our language. God's love will prevail. So while we're mucking around and being good and not good and half-baked and fully on fire, whatever you're doing in your life and I'm doing in mine, and they're all telling us which way to go, to don't muck around with our life, because it has terrible effects if we do it bad, and it can have beautiful effects if it's good. But whatever we're doing, and the Bible keeps going back to this, we're not the centre of attention of everything. We're not the subject of all the verbs. God is the organiser. God is the lover. God is the creator. God's the one holding everything in existence. So there is always present grace. And so all will be well. Maybe not for me, if I don't link in with it, and maybe not for my children if I don't care for them. You know, it's not automatic stuff, but there'll always be love there, so that as I die on a cross as a thief, having buggered up my whole life, it's always possible for me to turn to him, even at the last moment, and say, oh, shiver me timbers, I was a priest for 60 years and I made such a mess of it. But I really, would you give us a break? And he'll put his arms around and say, yeah, sure, come. Because we're alive while we're alive, aren't we? And God is wanting love, nothing more.